This is the second day of this December 2011 four-day session. And we'll resume reading from the teachings of the Chinese master Yang Shi, 13th century master. This is from a book called The Original Face, an anthology of Rinzai Zen, translated and edited by Thomas Cleary. We left off yesterday with him talking about practicing virtue. The last sentence we read of his is, "To practice virtue in hopes of reward is the illusion of ordinary people. Bodhisattvas do not seek for the resulting rewards as they cultivate roots of virtue, because they cultivate goodness for the sake of impartial love and compassion, and thus it becomes sustenance for enlightenment. And now, as for those who seek rewards as they cultivate virtue and attain the lesser reward of humanity or godhood, this is surely the work of birth and death." Again, humanity and the realms, the two highest realms of unenlightened existence, humans and devas or gods, heavenly beings. He's not saying that this is an awful thing to cultivate virtue with in the hope of getting something out of it in the future. He just says it's the work of birth and death. That is, it doesn't liberate us from the cycle of birth and death, a wheel of samsara. We can acquire a favorable rebirth, but still one subject to change. We can still sink into the lower realms of unenlightened existence as long as we're in that wheel of life and death. Question: without accumulating virtue and good qualities, how can one become a Buddha, in whom myriad virtues are complete? So he's asking, how can we climb up the ladder of karma all the way to Buddhahood if we're not accumulating virtue and doing good things? And then Langshi, "It takes three incalculable eons to attain Buddhahood by accumulating virtue and good qualities." That's a very, very long ladder. But if you practice the way of unity of cause and effect, you realize Buddhahood in one lifetime. Someone who illumines his own mind and awakens to his real nature sees that he himself is originally Buddha, not now attaining Buddhahood for the first time. So as long as we conceive of ourselves making progress, as long as we conceive things in terms of evolution and devolution or progress and regress, then it may take many millions of lifetimes. But why cling to that notion? Why not just open our eyes, awaken to our self nature, this true mind, right now? And see, because what it reveals is that we have always been Buddhas. From the very beginning, all beings are Buddha. This passage, he says, if you practice the way of unity of cause and effect, brings to mind what we just recited in the Hakuin chant, then the gate to the oneness of cause and effect is thrown open. Here too, it's another notion. The notion of causation is all within the realm of the conventional side of reality, the relative side, the side of differentiation of here and now and this and that and past, present, and future, here and there. Awakening reveals the oneness of cause and effect. That there is ultimately no time. Awakening reveals this realm, the realm of the essential, in which there is no time, no space. You can't talk about it. It's not applicable. N/A. It doesn't apply. These things of time and space and enlightenment and non-enlightenment. Roshi Kaplow in his introductory workshops used to use the as a simile of these two sides of reality, the absolute and the relative. He used to use the example of a watch, a wristwatch, where on the face of it, that's the side of relativity, the conventional. It's all about change, this and that, time, space. The backside of the watch, if you think of the watch, if you think of the backside as just blank, nothing on it, then that's the other side, where such categories don't obtain at all. So the watch itself is both sides together as one. But until awakening, the best we can do is look at one side of the watch and the other side and the one side and the other side and just conceptually appreciate that they can't be two. The real challenge for us is to grasp this experientially. It's like the difference between someone describing the watch, the two sides of the watch, or taking it in your hand. So just to reread this, someone who illumines his own mind and awakens to his real nature sees that he himself is originally Buddha. It says seeing the backside of the watch, you could say, and then as coexisting with the face of the watch. Originally Buddha, originally whole and complete. The opposite, the inverse of the doctrine of original sin. It may just be more a matter of vocabulary, because in Buddhism we don't deny that we come into this life, each one of us at birth, with our share of karma. We come in with, I guess, some faint some faint echo of greed, anger, and delusion that doesn't really show itself until we have matured some. But still, yes, greed, anger, and delusion as our common lot, and Buddhahood, pure Buddhahood. Or as the Buddha said, this mind is pure and self-luminous, but it is stained by adventitious defilements. Adventitious meaning that which comes and goes, that which is not essential to our nature. Question. Do those who realize Buddhahood by seeing reality not depend on cause and effect? Should they not cultivate virtue? Answer. Although those who realize Buddhahood by seeing their true nature may cultivate virtue, they do it for others' benefit, not for rewards. Because they teach and transform sentient beings, they teach cause and effect. Because they know they have no personal gain, they do not depend on merit. They have no mind at all. That is, no mind at all, meaning no mind of self-interest, profiting from one's good deeds. No strategizing for how to get into heaven. So, of course, what he's talking about here is a very, very exalted state, a pure, pure state of upholding the precepts for others' benefit. This is what I'm always trying to hammer away in my talks on the precepts. Upholding the precepts is just a way to move through life without causing unnecessary pain to others or to oneself. Ultimately, you can't really tease them apart. If we're causing pain to others, then we're incurring pain ourselves. Question. What is no mind? If there is no mind at all, who sees reality, who awakens to the way, and who can expound the way to teach? Well, these are actually wonderful questions. Who sees reality? Who is it who awakens? Who hears this teaching? Who is it who's hearing this teaching? Who's breathing? Who's breathing right now? Is it simply a matter of me breathing? Or is it equally being breathed? We sleep through the night every night with no intention of breathing. We're breathed. And it functions just fine without our conscious intention, our conceiving of it as us doing something. And then Lanshi's answer. No mind means that there is no deluded, foolish mind. It doesn't mean there is no mind to discern false from true. If one doesn't think of sentient beings, really, this is just a direct translation from the Chinese, but it really means so-called unenlightened beings. Sentient beings. In Chinese texts, sentient beings always means the unenlightened. If one doesn't think of sentient beings, doesn't long for Buddhas either, in other words, you're not caught in that dualism of the enlightened and the unenlightened, doesn't think of illusion or seek enlightenment, doesn't go along with the honor of others, does not hope for fame, profit, support, or reputation, does not shrink from attacks from those who are resentful or hostile, and does not add any discriminating thoughts about any good or evil, one is called a no-minded wayfarer. So this is an important distinction that Lanshi is drawing here, that this word, no mind, it's a unique Zen word. I've never run across it anywhere else. No mind. It means free of any attachment to the discriminating mind. No mind is what is functioning when an athlete is in a state of flow, responding in milliseconds to what is before her or him. No mind is functioning when a musician is completely in that same state of flow. No mind is what is mother responding to her infant. No mind is us when we respond to someone who is in pain. It is when we are unshackled from our habit of attaching to our thoughts that we are most responsive. It's our thought activity that tends to bind us and prevent us from responding freely. So no-minded activity or responsiveness is the highest state we can reach. State of freedom. Let's break this down, this long sentence. If one doesn't think of sentient beings, doesn't long for Buddhas either, well, we mentioned that, doesn't think of illusion or seek enlightenment. Seek enlightenment, as I so often say in Taisho, just means not clinging to the goal of enlightenment. Enlightenment as a thought, that won't help us at all. That's a huge hindrance. And also, don't think of illusion. Don't be thinking about ourselves as being deluded, unenlightened. Doesn't go along with the honor of others. I don't get that. Does not hope for fame, profit, support, or reputation. I think that's self-explanatory. Because a hope is also a thought. Does not shrink from attacks from those who are resentful or hostile. Now, this is another description of another very pure state. Does not shrink from attacks from those who are resentful or hostile. And this is one we, most of us, have a chance to test ourselves on from time to time. I don't know if anyone can move through life without being the object of others' hostility or resentment, at least now and then. And the way we react to expressions of hostility is a key, very excellent test of how much we are caught in our own self-concern, our own ego. There's a koan in the Blue Cliff Record, number 97, called the Diamond Sutra and Being Reviled. And this is how it goes. It's a short one. The Diamond Sutra says, "One who is reviled by others has done wicked acts in former lifetimes which doom him to fall into evil worlds. But because of the scorn and vilification by others in the present life, the transgressions in the former life are wiped out." Implied in this, not explicitly said, but implied in this is, it's not just that we can hope to be the brunt of others' scorn and vilification, and that's a way we can expiate obstructive karma, but it's how we respond to those words of disparagement or mistreatment of any kind. This is where the rubber hits the road as far as spiritual practice, when someone talks to you or acts towards you in a way that you feel is unfair, you're being mistreated. How do you respond? Of course, the average person will lash out at the attacker, try to get even with him or her, or file it away and get even later. Some people, rather than reacting that way, will sort of fold in on themselves and sort of do the same thing to themselves. How can we avoid those kinds of reactions, which just bind us to suffering when we react those ways? And then he continues, and does not add any discriminating thoughts about any good or evil. This is so common. We do this so reflexively, most people, that we may not even be aware of it. The ways that in which we, like a knee-jerk, the ways in which we judge people and things that happen to us. We're always ready to add this unnecessary layer of judgment. Sashin reveals this habit, and what a habit it is. This in Doksan, I hear from people new to Sashin, this is one of the most common things they report with some awe, as in awful, how habitually this judgmental mind is working, almost continuously working in subtle ways that we usually don't notice, but in the silence of Sashin, where we've got nothing, nowhere to run, nowhere to hide, then this judgmental voice becomes so painful. The arrogance behind it, of the ways that we judge other people, usually in our thoughts. It's all separation, separating ourselves from people, standing in judgment over people. Maybe these people don't sense the way we're judging them, but we are causing ourselves pain with this habit of standing apart in judgment of others. Habit is another simple word for karma, the law of causation. I recently heard someone say, first you make a habit, and then the habit makes you. That's karma. And the root habit that binds us to suffering is this habit of dividing in the mind, conceptualizing. So if one doesn't do, he says, if one doesn't do all that stuff, if one isn't mentally dividing the world into self and other, us and them, right and wrong, good and bad, one is called a no-minded wayfarer. All of this work we're doing is really kind of untying the knots that we have been tying for lifetimes. Starting by loosening them. It's actually another nice metaphor. I think this is from the Buddha himself. A nice metaphor for the kind of attention we need to bring to the practice in order to disentangle ourselves from our thoughts is when we have, let's say, a knot in our shoelaces, for anyone who may ever still have shoes with shoelaces, it takes a kind of meticulousness to examine that knot. Not just to tug at it, it just tightens it further, but to really look very closely. The difference, this analogy is, breaks down as all do eventually, but the problem with this analogy is that it's not that we're doing the untying, it's rather that it's being untied. It's like that breathing. It's not that simply that I'm breathing, but also I'm being breathed. Breathing is happening. The untying of the knots is happening. Trust the process. It's happening. It's not happening as fast as we want it to, but it's happening. It's happening at the very speed in which it needs to happen. Who's breathing? Who's untying what? trust the process. Question: are there differences of more or less merit in fasting, upholding the precepts, and reading and reciting sutras and dharani? I think we get a sense of what a central place merit had in Buddhism historically. It was, from what I have, my reading, it seems that most people, whatever practice, however they engaged in Buddhist practice of any kind, it was usually for the purpose of getting merit and having a favorable lifetime next time around. I think historically it would mean being born in, as I'm becoming a monk in one's next lifetime. It's such a dreary kind of accounting state of mind, just trying to keep filing, making deposits in your merit account. And yet, when Bodhidharma responded to the emperor and he said no merit at all, then the emperor asked him, what merit have I acquired in building monasteries and supporting monks? And Bodhidharma replied, no merit at all. Very famous reply. He was balancing the emperor's attachment to merit. He wasn't saying that there is no way in which merit doesn't happen. All the time we are either developing merit or not. And well, let's just go to Lanchi's reply here. He asks about fasting, upholding the precepts, reading and reciting sutras and dharani. And he says, eating once a day removes greed for food and results in great blessings and virtue in the coming life. This is... eating once a day is more strict than the traditional monastic code, which is to eat twice a day, have breakfast and then lunch, and that's it for the rest of the day. You don't eat after noon. So here, all right. So that's fasting. Morality and discipline is also to stop bad states of mind and produce a good mental state. You notice it says morality and discipline is, because they're really the same. Is to stop bad states of mind and produce a good mental state. See, here he's talking about good and bad. So this is the relative half of reality. It's not that there is no better or worse kind of activity or better or worse karma. Of course there is. It's just only half the picture. Those with good minds live in human and heavenly realms in the highest estates. Those who read the sutras protect and maintain the teachings of the enlightened ones. These people will have great knowledge and wisdom in the coming life. No mind is the Buddha mind. The qualities of this enlightened mind cannot be reached by words or thought. It is truly inconceivable. There's the back of the watch again. one of Lanchi's immediate predecessors, Asai Zenji. Zen Master Asai is credited with having introduced Zen to Japan, and these are his, some words by him. This also was in the Rinzai, this is the Rinzai tradition. Dogen gets credit for doing it in the Soto tradition, but Asai said, "Great is mind. Heaven's height is immeasurable, but mind goes beyond heaven. The earth's depth is also unfathomable, but mind reaches below the earth. The light of the sun and moon cannot be outdistanced, yet mind passes beyond the light of the sun and moon. The macrocosm is limitless, yet mind travels outside the macrocosm." Mind here, in each case, is this capital M mind, our true mind. "How great is space, how great the primal energy. Still, mind encompasses space and generates the primal energy. Because of it, heaven covers and earth upbears. Because of it, the sun and moon move on. The four seasons pass in succession, and all things are generated. Great indeed is mind." No mind is the Buddha mind. Same thing. Call it mind, call it no mind. Not two. And then Lanchi here continues in talking about virtue and our efforts to build virtue. "All roots of virtue and good qualities are conditional, whether they be heavenly or humanly mundane. No mind is immediate witness of the path of enlightenment, so its merit cannot be adequately expressed in words. Really, it is the condition of the one great matter. The afflictions of birth and death die away of themselves. Mind and body are one thusness. This is what it is. How can there be any doubt about the immediate mind realizing Buddhahood?" I mentioned some worldly examples of no mind, the functioning of no mind in sports and music. Well, of course, we can dip into this no mind. We can actualize this no mind through complete absorption in our practice. Samadhi. And we discover in this state of no mind or no thought how trivial are the workings of this discriminating mind, how superficial they are by comparison to this awe-inspiring functioning of mind. So the thoughts in our mind sound so tinny and utterly inconsequential when we are dwelling in this state of no mind that is beyond thought, complete absorption in the practice. I'm going to skip a page here and then go to the next question. "Is this body to be considered illusion? Can it be considered enlightenment? And what is the mind? The basis of illusion and enlightenment, it should be known. And is the mind inside the body or outside the body? Where does it come from?" And then Lanchi, "The body of four gross elements, fire, water, earth, and air, and five skandhas, form, feeling, thought, choice, consciousness, fills the universe. All sentient beings are the foundation. Causes and conditions interact to form physical bodies. This is called birth. When the results of the causes and conditions change and die out, then the four elements disperse. This is called death. In form and characteristics, there are ordinary people and awakened ones. In the essence of mind, there is no delusion or enlightenment. Even so, we provisionally define the deluded as sentient beings and the enlightened as the Buddhas. Delusion and enlightenment are just creations of the deceiving mind. In the real mind, there is no illusion or enlightenment. This simple description of birth and death, causes and conditions interact to form physical bodies, this is called birth. It's not, of course, just birth in the literal sense. It's the birth of anything is the interaction of causes and conditions, which are impermanent, are evanescent. Let's change the terms here. Causes and conditions interact to form relationships. This is called marriage. When the results of the causes and conditions change and die out, then the four elements disperse. This is called divorce. This example just popped in my mind as I was reading this paragraph. It's true. It's not very romantic. But true that causes and conditions form affinities between two people. There's an affinity that reaches a certain threshold, and then there's a commitment that we call marriage. But that affinity, those causes and conditions that bring us together with the spouse, are not set in stone. Nothing is. It's all flux. And when those causes and conditions change sufficiently, then the two people part. It doesn't need to be any great drama. I mean, usually there is, unfortunately, but it doesn't need to be. Roshi Kaplow went through a period where he would talk this way at a wedding. He would... Where there's this little, in our weddings, there'd be a little chance for the officiant, Roshi Kaplow then, where he would say a few words about weddings. He would say this. He'd say, John and Mary have come together here because of their karma, and when their karma exhausts itself, they'll be apart. Not the best time to bring forth that teaching. But of course, it's in any relationship, teacher and student, any kind of teacher and student, music, academic. When we come to understand relationships, and everything's relationships, you know. When we come to understand relationships this way, it grants us a degree of detachment where we don't have to get caught up in a big melodrama when two people part in whatever kind of relationship they have, romantic or professional or anything else. This stuff goes beyond what any of us want. There's an intelligence that is at work that is bigger than any of us. This doesn't mean that we want to adopt a passive kind of shrugging resignation to say when there are problems in a marriage or problems between teacher and student. No, we want to work with it. We want to work with it as we do with our practice. Hey, there's another relationship, our practice with our koan or with a breath. There are better periods and worse periods. There are times when we're very intimate with our practice. There are other times when we feel distant from it. We work with it when we feel distant. But who's to say whether someday our affinity with the particular practice or the person might just have exhausted itself, and then we're on to something else. All right, our time is up. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.